Hi, good lunchtime. Huh? Nice to have you here. You're in for a real delight and a delicious talk by Sir Richard Peto, who's the director of the Clinical Trials Unit at Oxford. Richard spent a long time. He said we should introduce him as the late Sir Richard Peto, since he's worked for more than 30 years with the late Sir Richard Dahl on those classic longitudinal studies of doctor studies on cancer, smoking, and the health risk from smoking. Richard spoke here 4 years ago about having premature deaths. And when I spoke to him and when we launched the Disease Control Priorities Project in Beijing in April, he got up and gave an overview of whether we could actually use the different interventions posed by the Disease Control Priority Projects to reduce mortality in the developing world. In his overview, after he gave his overview, I said, Richard, is it really realistic? And so he's come back to answer the question, is having premature deaths in the developing world really realistic? Richard, it's a delight to have you here back at NIH and to entertain us with your thoughts on whether we can really do what you've set out. Thank you.
No, it's okay. In summary, we've managed to halve premature deaths in many populations over the last few decades, and I don't see why we shouldn't do it again over the next few decades. But there are some parts of the world and some populations where things have been getting substantially worse, and it's this sort of mixture. The trends in mortality are so extreme, really, it should be possible to control them and to have substantial effects. Okay, let's see, what's the next one? This there? Yes. This is the graph I started with when I was talking here 4 years ago on halving premature death, and I asked people to guess what it was. And if anybody who wasn't here last time feels like guessing, I mean, as a clue, what do I point with this thing? These are human beings, this is age, and this is the percentage still alive. Now, what population is that? And it turns out to be French males born in 1896. That's the wrong way. How the hell did it get there? Can somebody help me with this thing? I seem to have got end of slideshow pressed to exit, which I certainly don't want to do. No, that's nothing to do with it. That's the end of it all. Right, let's go right up to the beginning then. How did I get there? What's anybody... Okay, well, at least the talk all seems to be there. That's good. Yeah. And, you know, when you suddenly press the button, it jumps to what might have been the last thing. Then you get worried. Okay. If I go up, 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 right. Okay, there we are, back again. And... slideshow. Oh, God. This thing is hypersensitive. Okay. This graph is French males born in 1896. A quarter of them died in early childhood because that was what people did in Europe in the beginning of the 20th century. In Britain as well, a quarter would die in early childhood, which is worse than any country in Africa at the moment, unless you've got, you know, really horrible civil war. When you get really bad civil war, you get mortality like you got in Britain or France at the height of European colonial power. And then, of course, Europe had its civil war, and a third of the young Frenchmen died within 5 years in the First World War. But then, when they get to middle age, half of those who got to middle age died in middle age. And this is the situation 100 years ago in the best placed populations, in one of the best placed populations in the world. And what we've got to do if we want to halve the death that remains is just take the big causes and deal seriously with them. You can get things that are worse than this. This a quarter dead is just the national average. If you went to the cities, you could finish up, before there's sewage, you could finish up with things even worse. Here is Liverpool in 1860, at the height of British power in India. Half the kids were dead before the age of five because the place was so filthy. And of those who actually survived to five, substantial numbers died before 35. And then of those who reached 35, nearly all died before 70. And this would have been typical of, say, Manchester, the East End of London, many of the big cities. In fact, the cities were so unhygienic that people had to flood into them into the countryside to maintain the population. And if you compare that with the present in Britain, there's Liverpool in 1860, and there's England in the 1990s. Nowadays, something like 98% of the kids that are born at current death rates could expect to survive to middle age. And then you start getting deaths in middle age. So you've got this enormous change in mortality has already happened. It hasn't happened everywhere in the world, but it's happened in the developed countries of the world. Here, again, is just the under five mortality in England from 1838 to 2002. And each dot is the mortality rate among males under five in a given year. 1838 is when death started to be registered in England and Wales. And throughout the 19th century, the death rate stayed high. About a third would die before the age of five. And then in the 20th century, it started to come down. A lot of this, of course, is perinatal death. A lot of it's perinatal death and death through infection. But really, there weren't any effective antibiotics until the 1930s, when sulfonamides came in, and then in the 1940s, you get penicillin and a number of other antibiotics. And so the death rate comes down. But even from the 1950s here to the present, mortality's gone down to a quarter of what it was in the 1950s. The changes in premature death, in death in childhood, death in early adult life, in countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, are quite extraordinary. It's a complete transformation of the human condition. Here you've got a third of the kids dying in the first, well, often in infancy, and here we've got less than 1%, actually it's about 0.5% die. It's been the most extraordinary change. And it means that it does say that where these changes have happened in some countries, they can happen in other countries. Worldwide, in the early 1950s, a quarter of the, about 23%, a quarter of the kids that were born would die before the age of five. You've got massive child death rates in India, China, in the developing countries of the world, around Africa. And worldwide, things have got better very fast. This thing's sort of out of control. It seems to jump. Maybe the table's got shiny bits on it. So by the early 1970s, under five mortality was down to 14%. By the 1990s, it was down to 9%. And now it's about 8%. That's still 10 million deaths out of 130 million. It's still a lot of deaths. But it's only a third of what it was. That's the worldwide pattern. In the developed countries of the world, obviously, it's much better. We've still got 10 million deaths. And if the whole world had West European death rates, that would be 1 million deaths. But if we still had the death rates of Western Europe in 1900, it would be 30 million deaths. If we still had the deaths of the world in 1950, that it would be 30 million deaths. So it's 10 million instead of 30 million, but it's also 10 million instead of 1 million. And then the question is, what are these 10 million deaths due to? What are the causes? What diseases are involved in these 10 million deaths? Are they things that we could do something about? Well, quite a lot of the deaths are perinatal deaths. And if you counted stillbirths as well, there's about another 3 million stillbirths. You've got about 6 million either stillbirths or perinatal deaths. And most of these, really, they really require kids to be born in clinics. If kids are born in clinics, as in China, then you're going to have lower child death rates than you get if they're born at home, as in India or Africa. And it doesn't need very complicated clinics, it doesn't need very complicated interventions to limit the number of perinatal deaths. This is something which has changed enormously, and you don't have to be rich, it doesn't have to be a rich country to do this, it's not a very expensive thing, but you do need competent people around to get the kid out alive and also to make sure that the mother doesn't die. There are 500,000 maternal deaths every year, which is still a huge number of unnecessary deaths, and the deaths of young women, often with families. Very often the kids that are left alive then finish up dying of increased death rates because the mother is not there. Then there's about 2 million deaths from acute respiratory infection. Well, you know, when people really started counting how many were dying of what in the 1980s, there were about 3 million, 4 million deaths a year from acute respiratory infections. Now it's down to 2 million. Diarrhea was 3 million, now it's down to 1.5 million. And one of the reasons for this is the actual deliberate introduction of oral rehydration salts. It was realized in the 1970s that kids who were dying of diarrhea were actually dying from dehydration, and they were dying in circumstances where you couldn't put in an intravenous line. They were dying in poor circumstances where there wasn't clinical help around that could put in intravenous fluids. But they were dying because they couldn't absorb the water, and it was realized that if you could just put a bit of salt, a bit of sugar with the water, then it could be absorbed and you could avoid these deaths from dehydration. And this was done, and over a period of a few decades, it became normal as treatment to give oral rehydration rather than intravenous rehydration. And as a result, the diarrheal death rate has dropped. There are other things that can be done. There are vaccines available against certain types of diarrhea. But there's been a change, a sort of cultural change in a lot of villages towards the use of oral rehydration salts, fluids, to rescue kids with severe diarrhea who would otherwise be dehydrated and die. It isn't used as widely as it should be, but it is used quite widely, and it is contributing substantially to the reduction in the annual number of deaths from diarrhea. I'll take these two. These are vaccine-preventable diseases. Again, when estimates were made in the early 1990s of the annual number of deaths from this, that, and the other disease, the estimated number of deaths from measles was about 1 million. There is uncertainty in these estimates, but there really is a substantial reduction in measles mortality, and it's because the kids are getting vaccinated. It's because vaccines work and are being used. And measles vaccination is an extremely practicable thing to do. It's not an expensive vaccine, and you need quite simple structures to get these vaccinations to happen. Again, it doesn't require a huge economic change. You don't have to have massive economic development, as in, say, South Korea, to get the society rich before you can actually avoid the child deaths. Diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, these are vaccine-preventable diseases. There's about 1 million deaths a year from vaccine-preventable diseases, so wider extension of vaccination is taking place and will substantially reduce these. The Gates Foundation gave money to the Gavi, to the Alliance on Vaccines, and it costs, if you're going to try to get a million extra kids vaccinated, the main cost is actually the logistics, but it's about $20 million per million vaccinated. So it does involve money, but not enormous amounts of money. So there are, if you're going to have an extra 10 million kids a year vaccinated, then that's another $200 million a year. Well, it's about 1% of what's spent on tobacco advertising in this country. HIV does cause large numbers of deaths, but most of them are not before the age of five. It's about 3% of all mortality is HIV before the age of five. Well, that's a big fraction of the mortality in the age range 5 to 34. I want to just stop a bit on the malaria. It's 1 million deaths a year, maybe more. I mean, the estimates are uncertain. It may be more because malaria can contribute to sort of general weakness and susceptibility to other diseases. And so some of these deaths from diarrhea, from acute respiratory infections, from various other things, may be indirectly due to the child being weakened by malaria, by malnutrition. But malaria itself directly kills kids. And the solution has to lie in near-home treatment. And in a way, the decisions on whether near-home treatment is going to happen are political decisions that are being made in the rich countries of the world, in particularly here in Washington, in the World Bank, and in the World Health Organization, but particularly the big financial decisions. Because what's needed is something like a global subsidy for the production and distribution of antimalarials. Malaria used to be controllable by extraordinarily cheap drugs. Chloroquine would cost about, say, 10 cents for a curative course. And at that price, even poor people could afford to use chloroquine. But the mosquitoes became resistant to chloroquine, and death rates in East Africa particularly from malaria have been rising. It's one of the few diseases other than HIV where the number of deaths is actually going up, and it's due to the failure of chloroquine as a treatment. Chloroquine is no longer effective. Then there was another drug going to be used, SP, sulfadoxin pyrimethamine, which was effective for a time, but whereas the bugs took a long time, the malaria parasites took a long time to find out how to be resistant to chloroquine, they very rapidly learnt how to be resistant to SP, which is a great shame because SP again was very cheap. And the most effective drug at the moment, the Artemether artesinates, it's a derivative of the Chinese Qinghao Su, unfortunately they do actually cost more to make. The problem with malarial drugs isn't patents. It's not a question of patented drugs and drug companies making profits. If the drugs are manufactured at cost, then artesunate costs about 10 times as much as chloroquine did. And when you go from 10 cents for a curative course to a dollar as a curative course, it suddenly becomes really quite a big obstacle to the kids who are dying from malaria actually getting effectively treated. And probably the only solution is to get a global procurement. This is with the recommendation of the Institute of Medicine, to get global procurement of artesunate, or strictly artesunate in combination with other drugs, get good quality drugs procured and then fed into all the various distribution systems at really heavily subsidized prices on a scale large enough that the whole world is treated. It's estimated this would cost of the order $500 million a year, but it would probably avoid something like 500,000 deaths a year, as well as leading to much more effective treatment of a lot of extremely unpleasant disease. And malaria also causes symptoms as well as deaths, but particularly if these child deaths are going to be avoided, then there's got to be near home treatment. And the reasons is because worldwide there's about 1.2 million deaths from malaria, but about 0.1 million of them are in people over the age of five, and about 1.1 million are people under the age of five, mostly in Africa. It's mostly African kids under the age of five. These numbers may not be exactly right. They come from the latest issue of the Global Burden of Disease, which was released in Beijing in April. But they're not wildly wrong. Something of the order of a million. Joel Brennan says 2 million, but something like a million or more kids under the age of five are dying because of malaria, and any kid that gets ill with malaria could be cured by a treatment that costs a dollar to make. And it's an organizational thing how we actually get. There is the will to spend money like that, but it just needs the correct political decisions to get this, the macroeconomics right for global subsidy, and then get the microeconomics right so it does actually get distributed. These deaths can be very rapid, and they generally take place in rural areas. Now, kids in villages in Africa get quite a lot of fevers every year, so you can't take the kid hours to hospital every time a kid gets a fever. You're going to wait and see whether it's serious, and sometimes it can be less than 24 hours between the first symptoms and the kid actually being comatose or dead. So you know, when the infections that are really going to kill come, then you don't really have very much time. You've got to have the treatment available near home, not in a clinic, because there aren't clinics, not even in a simple clinic. It's got to be near home treatment. It's got to be in the village. It's even got to be in the hamlet where the kid lives. This was possible when the drugs were available cheap. You need to use all of the distribution networks. There are public health networks, pharmacies, shops, and chemical sellers, and also perhaps there needs to be some micromanagement of the incentives within the village. But the it's possible to do this. We need to get happening with malaria what's already happened with oral rehydration therapy. There needs to be a change in culture. With oral rehydration therapy now, there's the acceptance that, you know, in villages you give oral rehydration salts. And with anti-malarial treatment, we need acceptance that the routine needs to be some, one pill which is given rectally and then three more which are given orally. And the rectal treatment can be given even if the kid is vomiting or spit stuff up. I mean, you know, when I used to try and get deworming stuff down my kids, they just spit it out. And but rectal treatment, you just get it in there, hold it shut for about 10 minutes, then you've got enough in the blood to knock a thousandfold off the parasite count. And this can be done by non-medical people. It's the sort of it's a change, rather like the change that took place with oral rehydration salts. There needs to be this change in what is considered normal as just the treatment of fever. But for that, not only does there need to be the change in culture, the drugs need to be available as cheaply as oral rehydration salts, as cheaply as chloroquine used to be available. So it's a mixture of macroeconomics and microeconomics. Mortality from malaria isn't the only thing. Most cases of malaria don't kill, but there's huge numbers of malarial deaths in kids. There's hundreds of millions of cases in adults, and sure, you can worry about whether you treat adults or not, but if one of the main aims of malaria control is to use drugs to reduce global mortality, then one key need is effective, affordable, near-home treatment of children with unconfirmed, suspected but unconfirmed severe malaria in African villages and hamlets. I'll skip the next two, just too much talking. I'll be talking more about child mortality tomorrow in a rather smaller seminar. The ideal would be a low cost, but probably not zero cost. If you want stuff to be distributed, it may be better if it isn't zero cost. It can be available at zero cost in clinics, but if you want to use lots of other channels of distributing, it may be better. You may get far more kids treated if you have some incentive for people to actually sell stuff. And so and roughly speaking, commercial networks will double the price from the quayside to the bedside. So, you know, if you go through middlemen and then small distributors, if it goes in at 5 cents for a complete course of treatment, then it'll finish up coming out at the other end at 10 cents if normal commercial pressures have their way. But that gives you a huge distribution system, which you couldn't really get from public health networks. So that needs to run in parallel to public health networks. One rectal plus three oral. Perhaps it needs to be in a condom-like pack, so when you open it, then you've got all things exposed to the air, so you don't just give a bit and then leave the rest. One needs to get that the routine is rectal plus three oral. Once it's open, it cannot be resealed, so everything's then exposed to the air. And you can give doses where you don't have to do dosing by weight, and it needs to cost, say, 10 or 20 cents at the point of use in the village, not a dollar. Okay, that's enough on rectal artesanate. And the IOM is recommending a procurement agency. Well, I'll pass over that. Okay, so all of these things are things where you could get a substantial reduction by just doing what we've been doing and doing it a bit better. These things have, mortality has come down over the last 50 years by a factor of three, and it could easily come down by another factor of two without huge investment, unrealistic investment of resources. That's mortality at ages 0 to 4. Mortality at ages 5 to 34 is more difficult. Overall in the world, roughly, there are 60 million deaths a year. 20 million before middle age, 20 million in middle age, and about 20 million in old age. Well, death in old age isn't avoidable. I mean, anybody who reaches old age is going to die in old age. But most of the deaths before old age are avoidable. We've looked at mortality at ages 0 to 4. Let's have a look at 5 to 34. Well, 5 to 34, there's about 2 million deaths from HIV and about 5 million deaths from other causes at the moment. And there's another million or so deaths from HIV in middle age. You may get infected at 5 to 34 and then die after the age of 34. The HIV deaths, taking 0 to 34 and middle age, there's around 3 million deaths a year, say 2 million before middle age, 1 million in middle age, but there's about 6 million new infections a year. And so when I talk about halving premature deaths from where we are now, HIV is the one where we're not going to halve it in the near future.
if nothing else happens, if we're getting 6 million new infections, then actually the deaths are going to double as we get to where the future death rate matches the current infection rate. The treatments aren't curative, and they, you know, they make life better, but they aren't curative. And so as things are going, deaths from HIV are going to go up rather than down. Most of the new infections, some involve needles, some involve unsafe blood supply, some involve nothing to do with sex work, but most of the new infections involve either directly or indirectly female sex workers. And so the question of how transmission to female sex workers and then onto their clients, how can the female sex workers be protected? How can the clients be protected? And trying to eliminate prostitution has been, well, various societies have tried in various occasions, and it's not really a very practical strategy for limiting disease. It's like needle exchange, probably works better than telling people not to use drugs. And trying to get the sex workers so that they actually take care that they're not infected and that the behaviours aren't such that their clients or the sex workers will get infected is probably a more practicable strategy. And the point which, I mean, was made to me once somebody made it, it just seemed obviously true, is that if you want to influence the behaviour of sex workers, you really have to have some experience of what it's like to be a female sex worker, and actually older prostitutes are probably the best people to help younger prostitutes to work out how to protect themselves, how to protect their clients, how to produce circumstances where condom use becomes the norm. It has been done in some societies, not perfectly, but to a considerable extent. Thailand and South Africa were in a very similar situation in the early 1990s in terms of the beginning of the epidemic of HIV and the wide availability of commercial sex, a lot of commercial sex work. And Thailand really took it seriously at a time when South Africa was really concentrating on what on earth to do about apartheid. And so in Thailand, the situation stabilized with probably fewer than a million infected, whereas in South Africa it's gone up and there's probably more than 5 million infected. So you can have effects. I mean, the situation in Thailand isn't ideal, but it's a lot better than it would have been if they hadn't done anything. And the word for a condom now in Thailand is, I think, is Mechai, which was named after the Minister of Health at the time. And I think the answer is that we can intervene to halve what the new infection rate would otherwise have been. It's a rather limited ambition. It's not halving premature deaths. It's not halving the current death rate. But I think we could get serious action to limit what's going to happen if we don't try and take it seriously. In China, it's a big population. There is only a million infected, perhaps even under a million infected. It started off with drug users up in the top left and up in the bottom left of China, and with an extraordinary episode with blood transfusion where they, I mean, bizarrely, were collecting blood from people for transfusion purposes, and for some magical, mysterious reason, they decided that they were going to mix all the donated blood together and re-inject a little bit of it into everybody who'd given blood. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And there were rumours that it had caused a few hundred thousand infected, but really systematic surveys showed that it actually had caused probably just some tens of thousands infected. It's certainly quite newsworthy, though. So the epidemic has started in China, but it hasn't started, it's not yet, it doesn't seem yet to be very much in the female sex workers. There is a lot of prostitution now in China, but with a million infected, it is going to. They've got a million infected, and they've got something like 50 million, 100 million migrant labourers, you know, moving around from the countryside to the cities to get work. And it's absolutely set. What needs, and at one stage, the Chinese police had the rule that if a woman was found with two condoms in her bag, with more than one condom in her bag, then this could be used in court as evidence that she was a prostitute. Well, you know, that really isn't the way to encourage condom use. And so, I suppose that the key thing on HIV is not to try to impose your own morality on the way people choose to live, but just try and sort of, whatever they're going to do, then try to sort of protect them in doing it. That's probably the most practical. I don't know. Anyway, what about the other deaths, 5 to 34? External causes, accident, violence, suicide. Suicide's a million deaths a year. Traffic accidents are a million deaths a year. infections, malaria, not very much of a cause of death beyond age five, TB, again, about 1 million deaths a year, even if you exclude TB, which is caused by HIV and some pneumonia, but most of the pneumonia, once you get beyond age five, is pneumonia, which is secondary to HIV, so where HIV should be regarded as the underlying cause. But accident, violence, suicide, these are big causes in this age range, and they are difficult to do something about, but they're not impossible. You know, you get hundreds of thousands of deaths a year from traffic accidents in China, in India. There are things that can be done to limit this, which don't require extraordinary amounts of money being spent. Okay, 5 to 34, 0 to 4, definitely it's going to be possible to halve under 5 mortality. 5 to 34 is going to be very difficult. The HIV epidemic is increasing fast. Reducing transmission might well halve what we'd otherwise be. External causes are important, and they are difficult but not impossible to control. Okay, what about middle age? Middle age, I looked up middle age in the dictionary, and it said that it defined it as that period between youth and old age, variously reckoned to suit the reckoner, which is it's a lovely bit of dictionary writing, that. Actually, I looked up fucking in the dictionary as well, and the definition in the dictionary was meaningless emphasis, which, again, it's just lovely dictionary writing. Anyway, 35 to 69, I want it to be that period between youth and old age, variously, and I'm a reckoner. I want it to be, I don't want it to be so old that people think, oh, well, they'd be better dead anyway. So if you die in your 60s, then you still got quite a lot of good life ahead of you if you're lucky. And I want it to be old enough that you start getting it dominated by the chronic diseases, the vascular disease, the cancers. So this is the time when cancer, when heart attacks and strokes are causing substantial numbers of deaths, a big fraction of the deaths, and those killed are losing a lot. So at the moment, we've got 20 million deaths about before middle age, 20 million in middle age, 20 million in old age, and those killed before middle age are losing 40, 50, 60 years of life expectancy. Those killed in middle age are losing, say, 20-odd years of life expectancy. But if you don't die of one thing in old age, you'll die of something else. You avoid deaths in old age, and you're gaining only about 5 or 10 years per death. That doesn't say it's not worth doing, but it does say it's less worth doing, other things being equal, than death in middle age. So this is the period, and you can see that really, prevention of the deaths before middle age is more important, particularly because they're such soft targets, a lot of them. But some of the things that we can do in middle age are also soft targets. And when you're talking about tens of millions, then knocking off a few million off something that's causing tens of millions of deaths is really worth doing. Also, the number of deaths is going to go up. At the moment, the deaths in middle and old age are mostly heart disease, stroke, cancer. 80% of them are heart disease, stroke, cancer, or lung disease. And these, of course, are all things that are strongly affected by smoking. In developed countries, almost nobody dies before middle age. I'd say almost nobody. In Britain, about 2% would die before middle age. That's including accidents, violence, you know, malformations at birth, a lot. 98% survive to middle age now, and then about 1 in 6 will die in middle age. In developing countries, of the kids born in developing countries, about 1 in 3 will survive to middle age and then die in middle age. But in both cases, most of the deaths in middle age are from non-communicable diseases, vascular disease, cancer, and so on. So the question is, can we actually realistically hope to halve vascular mortality in rich countries and in poor countries? Can we reasonably hope to halve cancer? And I think the answer is yes. Also, it's not quite 20 million, 20 million, 20 million. If you say how many are dying in middle age now, then yes, it's 20 million. But if you say of the kids that are being born at present, how many are going to die in middle age, it's about 40 million. The present deaths in middle age relate to the kids born in the 1930s, 1940s, like me. But it seems to me that there are two fair questions. One could say, how many people are dying in middle age now? You've got 20 million deaths before middle age, 20 million in middle age. If you're saying, what's treatment worth? Well, that's the relevant statistic. But if you say how important is prevention, then it's the 20 million deaths before middle age and the 40 million deaths in middle age. You know, if we're talking about what's the relevance of whether kids smoke or not, well, that's relevant to the 40 million deaths that we're going to see in middle age when the young people of today reach middle age. So I think both are relevant perspectives. 20 million before middle age, 20 million in middle age is true of the present. 20 million in middle age, before middle age, and 40 million in middle age is what is going to be seen among those being born round about the present. And I think it's not that one or the other perspective is correct, but I think it's worth just bearing both perspectives in mind when discussing how important deaths in middle age are in terms of global health. Well, this is vascular mortality in Britain over the last 50 years, and it's an extraordinary change. It just illustrates the extent to which you can reduce vascular mortality, societies can reduce vascular mortality. I put this up to start with because people often think, oh, well, nothing changes, you can't change things. Well, you can. I mean, we have changed things enormously over the past few decades, and we can keep on changing them. This big decrease in male mortality is produced partly by decreases in smoking. A lot of men in Britain have stopped smoking, and partly by effective medication. And also there are some changes that aren't understood. There are some causes of stroke that have diminished, and we don't really know why. This isn't all deliberate, but a mixture of, you know, less smoking, perhaps changes in the nature of the fat in the diet of quite substantial importance, and also having medication, often quite cheap medication that works, has been important. This is mortality at ages 50 to 64, and this is mortality at ages 65 to 79. So there's this extraordinary decrease has been taking place in Britain, not in every country, but in the United States. Actually, it started in the US just before it started in Britain. And even 65 to 79, so we've seen big decreases, and if you can see changes like that, then we could have further changes like that. How are we going to halve vascular mortality in middle age? Well, we want both prevention and treatment. And treatments are now so good that they really can have a big public health effect. If you were to say in 1980, what's the relevance of treatment to the avoidance of death from vascular disease, it wouldn't have been much, because the big trials that have been done over the last 25 years hadn't yielded clear answers. But now we've got really good evidence that certainly for people at high risk of vascular disease, people who've had a heart attack, for example, and don't want to have another one, then aspirin really works well. Blood pressure lowering really works well. Lowering cholesterol, statins, really works well. These things are all out of patent. You know, collectively, they don't need to cost very much money, and they would be widely relevant not only in developed countries but also in any developing country where you've got enough facilities to actually recognize occlusive vascular disease. Tobacco, of course, is a huge cause. I mean, there's just recently, I reported yesterday at the tobacco conference, the first results from a big prospective study of 1 million women in Britain looking at those who smoke, comparing those who smoke with those who don't. And the relative risk, the death rates from vascular disease are four times as great in the smokers as in the non-smokers. So if the smokers stopped, if they had the heart disease stroke death rates of the non-smokers, three quarters of their vascular mortality in middle age would be avoided. Physical inactivity, it's becoming more and more definite that physical inactivity really is a cause of vascular disease. I keep meaning to do something about it and don't. You know, it's just like people keep meaning to stop smoking and don't. Obesity is also quite a big cause, although it actually works through blood pressure and blood lipids and to a lesser extent diabetes. The type of dietary fat can affect your blood lipids. It's not so much the amount of fat in the diet, it's the nature of the fats. And a switch in the type of fat used in cooking, used in food, is really quite practicable. It's not something that's actually very troubling to people. And I put there, and I've underlined it, extreme alcoholism. It's probably the really extreme alcoholism that's producing substantial risks of death. And you know, moderate drinking, again, the word moderate is a bit like things about middle age. What do you drink? Well, I'm a moderate drinker. But people could become a real pain to themselves and to other people in terms of the you know, the unpleasantness of being drunk all the time, before they really finish up with very high death rates from vascular disease. So there are other reasons for avoiding it, for avoiding there's a kind of alcoholism which is damaging to families and damaging to the individual. But you really have to go beyond that before you finish up with really high death rates. I'm not saying alcohol can't kill, of course it can. It can cause cancer of the mouth, esophagus, pharynx, larynx, cirrhosis of the liver, cancer of the liver, and so on, and also causes an increase in blood pressure. But it also does produce favorable changes in blood lipids. And most studies find that throughout most of the range of alcohol consumption in societies such as Britain or America, that those who do drink have somewhat lower death rates than those who don't. You know, so this isn't recommending or not recommending what one should or shouldn't drink, but it isn't, it's nothing like smoking as a cause of premature death. People say, oh, well, you know, you manage to live to 100. How come a hard drinking, hard smoking man like you live to 100? But it, you know, the hard drinking, the hard smoking aren't comparable. They are conversationally, but they aren't epidemiologically. The guy said, "Wow," I said, "I don't know. If I'd have known how long I was going to live, I'd have taken better care of my body." These are all relevant to primary prevention, and also particularly after you've had a heart attack or stroke, these things are still really relevant. If a smoker has a heart attack, then stopping smoking is one of the most effective ways of increasing their chances of still being alive 5 years later. You get a very rapid benefit because you've got high risk. But the other thing which is now relevant is long-term drug treatment of people at high risk. So the combination of aspirin, statin, and blood pressure lowering, these are all generic drugs. They can be generic drugs. If you're high risk for whatever reason, then these will, of occlusive vascular disease, then these will reduce your risk. And worldwide, I think the place to start is secondary prevention in middle age. If you take people in middle age who've had a heart attack or an occlusive stroke, but who've still got a reasonable quality of life and want to keep on living, then there's quite a lot of people like that. And the availability of combination drugs, low-cost combination drugs, Calendipac, one pill a day, it doesn't have to cost much, would be a really practicable way, in the cities at least, of the developing countries of the world, of reducing vascular mortality. And the absolute benefit is quite considerable. These are the results of the randomized trials in people who've already had a heart attack or occlusive stroke or some other evidence of occlusive vascular disease. The first thing that got tested properly back in the 1970s, 1980s was aspirin. At that time, there wasn't effective blood pressure control and there weren't effective cholesterol-lowering drugs. And so the recurrence rate in the control group was quite high, 7% per year. Down to 5% per year. 7% per year means about a 50% chance over 10 years. So about a 50% recurrence risk if you do nothing. So it went from 7% per year down to 5% per year. Then, against the background of aspirin, blood pressure lowering takes 5% per year down to 3% per year. Then against the background of aspirin and reasonable blood pressure control, the statin, simvastatin and drugs like that were tested and took 3% per year down to 2% per year. And if the statins had been invented first and the aspirin last, then it would have been the statin taking 7 down to 5 and it would have been the aspirin taking 3 down to 2. But overall, with the combination, you take 7% per year down to 2% per year, which means that you're changing a risk of about 1 in 2 down to a risk of about 1 in 6. You could avoid about two-thirds of the risk. It's a good absolute benefit. Okay, what else can we do? Well, there's a lot more to understand about blood lipids, and we can do a lot better than we're doing now. Same with blood pressure and obesity I'll come to, although it mainly works through blood lipids, blood pressure. This is what the epidemiology of cholesterol was, say, 20 years ago. The Mr. Fit screenees, 1/3 of 1 million American males, measure total cholesterol, watch them for a few years, standardize for everything you can, adjust for regression dilution, and you get this relationship. Now, this is a gross underestimate of the importance of blood lipids. Even with what we know now about how to measure bad cholesterol, good cholesterol, and, you know, bad cholesterol-carrying particles and good cholesterol-carrying particles, it's 4 times as important as that. So people used to say, look, cholesterol's really important, look how important it is. Well, already it's 4 times as important as that, and we're going to discover things about lipoprotein particles that make it even more than 4 times as important as that. If you take, there's bad cholesterol-carrying particles and good ones. This is a cartoon, but it's okay. Remember B for bad. B is bad and A1 is all right. And so this protein here on the surface of these particles is called ApoB, apolipoprotein B. And these particles, they're the LDL particles, and the cholesterol inside them is therefore called the LDL cholesterol. The cholesterol is all the same. Cholesterol is cholesterol no matter where. But if it's in the middle of an LDL particle, then it's called bad cholesterol. If it's in the middle of an HDL particle, it's called good cholesterol. These can deliver cholesterol to the coronary arteries and cause atheroma. These particles can scavenge excess cholesterol from the coronary arteries and prevent atheroma. So these can be protective. So you can either measure the total amount of cholesterol being carried by the good particles or the total amount being carried by the bad particles. This is called measuring the cholesterol fractions, LDL cholesterol, HDL cholesterol. And that's twice as predictive as just measuring total cholesterol, because total cholesterol is measuring both the bad and the good particles. So it's too crude. If you measure how much cholesterol is in the bad particles, how much is in the good particles, that's your LDL cholesterol and that's your HDL cholesterol, then you can be twice as predictive about risk as if all you know is the total cholesterol. But of the bad particles, the small ones are actually nastier than the big ones. And so measuring the total amount of cholesterol they're carrying isn't a very good way of doing it. It's better to just measure to count the particles. They've all got one molecule of ApoB, so if you measure the total amount of ApoB in the circulation, that's like counting the LDL particles. And that's more predictive than measuring the amount of cholesterol they're carrying, because the smaller LDL particles are more cardiotoxic. And the same with the HDL particles, the small ones are more cardioprotective. And so it's better to count them, in other words, to measure the ApoA1, than to measure the amount of cholesterol inside them, because you're undercounting, in a way, the most effective ones. And when you do that, if you measure ApoB and ApoA1, in other words, you count the bad particles and you count the good ones, roughly, then you finish up being four times as predictive of risk as if you just measure total cholesterol. And just by coincidence, it happens that just the ratio of ApoB to ApoA1 summarizes most of the predictive power of a single measurement of ApoB and ApoA1. So when you do a case control study, 2,000 cases, 7,000 controls, you get a relationship like this. This is just a single measurement of ApoB, ApoA1, and then calculating the ratio, how many grams per liter of ApoB to how many grams per liter of ApoA1. And you get this eightfold relative risk from the bottom tenth to the top tenth of the ordinary UK population. It's very nicely predictive. And there are drugs available now, the statins, which will take the ApoB and they'll make the liver resorb. It'll take the bad particles out. You take one pill a day and you can change, you know, an American cholesterol into a rural Chinese peasant cholesterol. And they don't seem to do any harm. They have some side effects, very rare. And the randomized trials have been done now, and they're just incredibly protective. They seem to do a lot of good and almost no harm. This is just comparing the predictive power of a two-standard deviation change in the BA ratio or a two-standard deviation change in total cholesterol. You can see total cholesterol is less predictive, and in old age it's not even significantly protective in a case-control study, whereas the BA ratio is protective, is independently relevant at all ages. And the trial results sort of match that. And when I say there's further to be gained, this is a graph of how much ApoB you've got versus how much LDL cholesterol you've got in a single blood sample. Of course, they're very closely correlated. And down here, here's the people with few bad particles. Here's the people with lots of bad particles. But actually, it turns out that if you go from this side of the cigar to this side, you know, as you go to smaller particles, then you finish up with greater risk. So it's a sort of independent risk factor, the smallness of the particles. So having measured ApoB, actually, the smaller the particle, the nastier. So measure ApoB, which counts the particles. Then when you measure LDL cholesterol, the less of it you've got, the higher your risk. LDL cholesterol isn't really a positive risk factor. It's a negative risk factor, given the number of particles you've got. And it's the same with the ApoA. Here's ApoA, which is basically the number of protective particles you've got. Here's HDL cholesterol, which is roughly the total amount of cholesterol they're carrying. And again, you're going up and down this cigar means more protection, less protection. But you can also go across it. The smaller particles are more protective. Okay, so there's more there to be learned, and there's probably more drugs to be developed. The statins are just the beginning. I think we've got to the point where drugs are so effective that we can really think around this as just the randomised trials of the statins. I want to belt through what I was going to say about blood pressure and just skip it and just try and do tobacco fairly briefly, because for the last 30-odd years I've been a tobacco addict. This is, oh, blood pressure. Actually, I will do the blood pressure a little bit. Look, this is what you get when you look at 1 million people prospectively, looking at blood pressure against heart disease. And this is among people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. There was all this mythology about J-shaped curves, normal values. Well, what's a normal value in this range? Wherever you are, lower is better. If you want to know whether you use blood pressure lowering treatment, don't measure the blood pressure, just give the treatment. Yeah, if doctors would throw away their sphygmomanometers, the patients would probably be safer. And it's the same with the blood lipids as well. The relationship between ApoB and risk is continuous throughout the normal range. And so if you classify people as low, middle, or high LDL cholesterol, low, middle, or high ApoB, then what are you going to do? If they've got high LDL cholesterol, you treat them. But if they've got middle LDL cholesterol, then they're better off with treatment. And if they've got low LDL cholesterol, then they're better off with treatment. So why measure it? You know, and if you want to use these things in developing countries, actually not measuring, just treat because somebody's had a heart attack. You don't have to screen. It's dead easy. It's a practical thing to do. There's the same thing, blood pressure versus stroke. So every, you know, it just produces, and these are the aspirin trials. This is the one you've already seen. A low-cost combination of pills, the main strategy of secondary prevention, could work globally wherever diagnosis of MI or occlusive stroke can happen. The 10-year recurrence risk would be reduced from about half without treatment down to about a sixth. Of course, if your first heart attack or stroke wipes you out, then it's not a very good strategy, but it is something that we could start with. It's doable, and it would make quite a big difference. Obesity, I'm trying to put too much in. Obesity is the main thing, is the main external cause of blood pressure, high blood pressure, high bad cholesterol, and low good cholesterol. So obesity is really important. And here is obesity versus coronary heart disease risk. You know, a very strong, important determinant of it. And the American population now has an average body mass index of 30, whereas Chinese peasants had an average body mass index of 20, at least in the 1980s. And Britain and America, body mass index is drifting upwards. In Britain, it's going upwards by about, you know, 1 point per decade, so about 2.5 points every 25 years. We're here, about 25 years behind you. And it does matter. But still, despite this, overall vascular death rates are going down, not up, because other things are actually progressing faster than the adverse effects of obesity. So, okay, obesity versus cancer is no big deal compared with obesity versus vascular disease. So obesity does matter. But despite that, UK, this is vascular mortality in early middle age, middle age, and in old age. These are the graphs you saw in Glorious Technicolor early on. There's the same thing for Eastern Europe. Sudden decreases since 1990. Obviously, democracy is good for you. Well, also they've smoking a bit less, and also they've changed their diet. They've changed their diet, they eat more animals, less animal fat, partly because the new governments couldn't afford the subsidies. The communist governments were putting in these sort of subsidies, the most incredibly unhealthy foods. They didn't dare cut the subsidies, otherwise the population would have revolted. So when the population did eventually revolt, the new government was bankrupt, couldn't subsidize the unhealthy stuff anymore, and the heart disease death rates went down. There's Russia. This is the spectacular alcoholism effect. That's the on the same scale. Vascular mortality in Russia zigzagging up, then down, then up. Look here. Have you ever seen a graph like that? It's amazing. And anyway, here's the United States, very similar to Britain. Very nice decrease, actually somewhat better than Britain in terms of the magnitude of the decrease in vascular mortality in early middle age, later middle age, and old age. So HIV, tobacco, and maybe obesity are the only big causes of death that are increasing substantially after owing for the worldwide growth in population. Cancer, tobacco predominates. Lung cancer among smokers, lung cancer versus age among smokers, among those who stop at 50, among those who stop at 30. Here's 1900 to 2000. Cigarette smoking in the United States, huge increase in the first half of the century, and then recently it's gone down to half of what it was. Then here's male lung cancer, then here's female lung cancer. And, you know, the women actually, if they smoke like men, they die like men. They just didn't actually get around to smoking as much as the men used to. So by the, over the last 25 years, this is total cancer mortality in the United States. here is the part caused by cancer, here's the part caused by smoking, here's the part not caused by smoking. And for the last 25 years, smoking has been causing about half of all the male cancer mortality in the United States, about half of the male cancer mortality in middle age, and actually also in old age as well, and an increase in proportion of the female. Here's Britain, even worse. For most of the last 50 years, smoking was causing more than half of all the cancer mortality in middle-aged men, but we've gone from having the worst tobacco death rates in the world to having the best decrease in tobacco death rates in the world. Because, I mean, it's sort of easy to have the best decrease if you've got the worst death rates. But, you know, it still is a fairly spectacular change. This total cancer mortality in Britain in 1970 was about 400. That was about 250 from smoking and 150 not. That's in the population as a whole, and that's the decrease. You know, it's extraordinary how avoidable death in middle age is. And this is the same thing for females, UK females. Okay, overall cancer mortality attributed to smoking, males and females, and here's what's happening in early middle age. Now this, it's even more promising. There's what's happening in middle age as a whole, which is dominated by what's happening in later middle age. It's gone down from 250 to 100, so it's gone down by about 60%. But in early middle age, the lung cancer death rates in Britain are down to a quarter of what they were. And this is due to changes in smoking, changes in the amount people smoke, and also changes in the nature of the cigarette. Although still the cigarettes are quite good at killing you. You still have about a 50% chance of being killed. And it's not due to changes in atmospheric pollution. And the reason we know that is because we've got a very good control group just 20 miles away across the English Channel. It's the French. Look at those. That's England, that's France. That's England, that's France. That's probably the French at the worst they're going to get, because in the 1990s they did start to take tobacco control seriously and introduce legislation, and French males suddenly decreased what they smoked. Suddenly cigarette consumption's gone down by a third among French males during the 1990s. And also, the nature of the cigarette has changed, so this is probably the worst they'll ever be, and probably we're going to see an equally spectacular decrease in France over the next few decades. But really, this is a political disease. It really is a political disease. And, you know, French women started to smoke in the 1960s, 1970s, you know, female liberation or whatever, and it became a sort of symbol, and they're really smoking seriously now, and they've already overtaken English women in terms of lung cancer. When you look at the female lines. Okay. The overall risk from smoking is about half all smokers get killed by the quarter being killed in middle age, and the key thing is that stopping works. Roger, can I talk 5 more minutes, or shall I stop now? Is that okay? Okay. 5 minutes guaranteed. Right. Okay, Richard Doll did a 50-year prospective study of smoking and death. And this, he asked all the doctors in Britain what they themselves smoked, and then followed them for 50 years to see who died of what. And the British doctors, Brits who were British males born in the early 20th century, it was the first population where they really started smoking young. And so you take British males born in the first few decades of the 20th century, follow them right the way through the century, and it's the first population where you can see the full effects of smoking. If you want to kill yourself by smoking, you have to start young and keep smoking. If you don't start young, you'll probably fail, and if you don't continue, you'll probably fail. But if you both start young and continue, you have about a 50% chance of success. And so among the non-smokers, 81% were still alive at 70, so 19% had died in middle age. Among the smokers, 42% had died in middle age. Or you can look at it this way, horizontally, that there's a 10-year shift. 81% of the smokers were dead by 60, 81% of the non-smokers, 81% of the smokers were alive at 60, 81% of the non-smokers were alive at 70. And here again, the smoker's risk of death at 70 is the same as the non-smoker's risk of death at 80. And the amount of disability before death is similar. So the difference is actually 10 good years. It's not 10 miserable years, it's 10 good years, because, you know, you get a certain amount of illness before death, and it's fairly similar for smokers and non-smokers. So you're actually losing 10 healthy years of life on average by smoking. It's an amazingly noxious habit for those who keep on doing it. And when these results were published, the doctors looked at the results in the British Medical Journal and thought, my God, this doesn't just kill doctors, it kills patients, it kills doctors. And so lots of doctors stopped smoking. And so they provided this very nice natural experiment. Here at age 40, here's survival from age 40 among those who continue to smoke, among those who never smoked, and the dotted lines among those who stopped at 40. So instead of losing 10 years of life, they lost about 1 year of life. They gained 9 years by stopping at 40. This stopping smoking works is the key thing. So on average, those who smoked lost about 10 years, those who kept smoking, but those who stopped 60, 50, 40, 30 gained about 3, 6, 9, or almost the full 10 years. And Britain as a whole has stopped smoking. Lots of Brits have stopped smoking. And so the overall probability of death has come down very nicely. You've seen the cancer death rates. This is the overall probability of death. At 1970 death rates, about 42% of the men had died in middle age, with 20 of those 42 deaths caused by smoking. At year 2000 death rates, about 25% would die in middle age, with about 6% of that was caused by smoking. And that's the same thing in females. Okay, I'm going to pass quickly over to the final point I want to make, which is what's happening worldwide for China with smoking. In the US, American adults smoked 1 a day, 4 a day, 10 a day on average in 1910, 1930, 1950. In China, the same thing, Chinese men, women have got more sense, Chinese men, the same thing happened 40 years later, 1952, 1972, 1992, the men smoked 1 a day, 4 a day, 10 a day. In the US, smoking was causing 12% of all the deaths in middle age in 1950, but it was causing 33% of all the deaths in middle age by 1990. We've got data for 1990 from China. We did a study of 1 million deaths in China, and 12% of the deaths were actually caused by, of the male deaths in middle age were caused by smoking. 2/3 of the young men smoke. Half were going to get killed by it. Smoking will be causing about 1/3 of all the deaths in middle age if those young men keep on smoking. It's going to kill about 1/3 of all the young men in China if they keep on as they are now. Smoking hasn't gone away as a cause of death. There's still 1 million new smokers a year and in the States, and there's about 30 million new smokers a year worldwide. That's 50% of the young men, 10% of the young women. So 30% of the young adults. There's about 100 million people reach adult life every year. About 30 million become smokers. If that carries on, and if most don't stop, say 20 million, more than 20 million don't stop, then we're going to finish up with more than 10 million tobacco deaths a year, which is about 100 million a decade. So this century, we're going to have about 150 million tobacco deaths in the first quarter, about 300 million in the second quarter, and then about 10 million a year, which would be more than 500 million in the second half. So that's about 1 billion tobacco deaths. Now, it really should be possible to knock a few hundred million off that total. Now, when we talk about halving premature death, it really should be possible to knock a few hundred million off that total. You can compare this with about 100 million tobacco deaths in the 20th century. And I think, but the key thing is cessation, adult cessation. It's not whether kids start. It'd be much better if kids didn't start, but a lot will start. If we're going to do anything about the deaths in the first half of the century, we need widespread cessation. And if we could reduce the number of kids starting, then that's going to avoid a lot of deaths around the middle of the century, the second half of the century. But even so, we're going to get a lot starting, and adult cessation is going to continue to be importantly relevant to the mortality around the middle of the century and in the second half of the century. It's an extraordinary story. I don't know how to put this together. That's about the end of what I wanted to say. If you look at nearly all the big causes of death, then they're avoidable. I mean, look at liver cancer, look at liver cirrhosis due to hepatitis B. It's vaccine preventable. There's so much is avoidable. And if we just take seriously the big causes, then we will be able to halve premature death. It won't give us eternal life, but it will be able to halve the probability of dying before old age. And that's not bad. It's not that everything is wonderful. It isn't. There's lots of, HIV is the worst medical problem in the world. And things could get much worse. I mean, maybe a few decades from now, there'll be some catastrophic social calamity, and people will be looking back at this time thinking, God, what were they talking about, halving premature death? Look at the horrible, brutal world we live in now. And just, it maybe that will happen. I mean, if you look at the 20th century, you almost feel that if it can happen, it will. But if we can avoid real social collapse, catastrophe, and whatever, then just taking seriously what we know now, you don't even need to discover a lot more that we're going to, and that's going to help. We really could greatly reduce the number of premature deaths, and I think we've halved premature death over the last few decades. Let's halve it again over the next few decades. Thanks.
Richard, that was brilliant, and it was fun, and you've encouraged us to live longer. You're our first Fogarty Visiting Scholar in Residence, so I want to congratulate you. I want to open the floor up to questions from the audience, but before I do, Julie Marquardt in our group prepared a painting from you based on the portrait. If Julie's here, she should come forward. Julie?
I'll take the questions first, actually.
But I wanted to give this to you, and it's a portrait that was on the of you that was on the screen at the very beginning. Is Julie here? Julie, are you here?
That's fantastic.
Julie, come on down. You should really make the. It's really your portrait, and you should make the presentation.
Thanks, Julie. It doesn't actually look as though I have avoided premature death, does it?
So that's why I introduced you as the late Sir Richard Peto, and this was the reason. There you go, Julie.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you very much, Julie. It's beautiful. And we'll leave this up here. Now we'll open up for questions. You can take a picture.
In recent years, The Economist magazine has had some...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
In recent years, The Economist magazine has had some interesting reports on increases in obesity around the world, and in particular in societies we don't normally associate with it. For example, young people in Japan.
Yeah.
In France, across the board, surprisingly. Are these figures realistic, and
yes.
What impact are they going to have?
Look, obesity is going up in lots of societies, and also in developing countries. As people move from the countryside to the town, you get an increasing prevalence of obesity, which then leads to increasing, hypertension, high blood lipid, adverse lipid patterns, and also diabetes. So this is definitely happening, and it's going to have adverse effects. It's going to make mortality rates from vascular disease worse. At the moment, we're managing in many countries to make them better by other things moving faster than the adverse effects of obesity. But certainly, the old joke about obesity being a growing problem is certainly true. And it's you can see it in many societies. But at the moment, the favorable effects of other changes are greater than the adverse effects of the increasing obesity. But, that won't last forever.
Richard, you made some very nice comparisons between England and France and related to tobacco. I'd also like to see then a comparison of the BMIs between those two countries, as well as between England and perhaps China, the other country which smoking has increased, mostly because looking at the relationship between smoking and obesity and whether or not we're substituting one vice for another.
I don't like talking about things as vices. I don't know.
Health vice.
Yeah. Well, there are changes in smoking, up in some countries, down in some countries, and in general, there's an increase in obesity rather than a decrease in obesity. That's the general pattern. And it is going to become increasingly important if it keeps on. I don't know how far it's going to go, but it is true in many societies that there is now a prevalence of obesity that wasn't there before. The net effect, rather curiously, you seem to have a minimum for overall mortality around about 25. I'm never quite sure whether that's really causal or not, because for some diseases, as you go down below 25, particularly respiratory disease, the mortality goes up. So probably around about 25 is around minimum mortality. And at the moment, you've got about two-thirds of Americans would be, well, actually a bit more than two-thirds now, would be over 25, over a BMI of 25. It's about two-thirds of the Brits, rather more than two-thirds of the Americans. I don't want to minimize it as a problem. It's just that at the moment, other things are at weighing the adverse effects of increasing obesity?
Yeah, I guess I would take issue with the idea of the way to reduce perinatal and maternal mortality significantly is to move all deliveries into facilities. I think we have experience, you know, in England, in Scandinavia, in countries in Asia, where actually mortality was significantly reduced by having midwifery care. And I'm not talking about traditional birth attendants, but I'm talking about professional midwifery care in the home. And it needs to be supported by a referral system with facility for those who need it. But I think it would, yeah. I caution the idea that all we have to do is move births into hospitals, particularly, or into clinics, particularly if you look at the conditions of those places like now, they would be overwhelmed, and I would judge that probably we'd have maybe potentially higher mortality.
What would your comment be on the situation in China, the changes in perinatal mortality in China?
Well, I also think that some of that was also just the one party, the one child rule, too. But I think they had reductions with the barefoot doctors, too, before they moved everything into health facilities.
Yeah. I mean, certainly in the early years of the communist regime, they during the 1950s, they actually got very substantial decreases in neonatal tetanus just by getting midwives to behave appropriately
and
not be vectors of the disease.
I think historically England was able to do it, Scandinavia certainly was, and more recent, and in the U.S. and the Frontier Nursing Service in Kentucky significantly reduced it. I think if in more recent examples, Singapore and Malaysia did it, and Indonesia right now has implemented a program of village-based midwives, which have begun to show some reductions too.
Okay. The thing is, you've just got to take some... You've got to have some kind of attendance, exactly what that should be. But it doesn't have to be very expensive, but you just can't let nature take its course, because if nature takes its course, then a lot of kids and a lot of mothers are going to die.
Right.
And there are various different intervention patterns possible. I think, I agree, it's not just a question of having clinics, and getting trained midwives and getting them at village level really would be a practical way of making a big difference. And in fact, in some of the worst places, that's probably the first way to not more than half off the mortality. Although it may well be that something more structured later on is preferable.
Yeah, I was curious about why you did not discuss the possibility of preventing HIV/AIDS deaths in terms of those who are already infected using heart drugs. You discussed the possibility of preventing new infections, but you didn't. And actually, that's something that's going on a rather large scale right now, the Global Fund and everything.
Yeah, there's been a big decrease. You can just see it in the U.S. overall death rates. If you take all-cause mortality in the United States among people in their late 30s, then it sort of suddenly in the males suddenly starts to it had been decreasing for some time. It suddenly turns around and starts to go up in the 1980s, and then in the 1990s it does suddenly turn around and come down because of the use of drugs. And the trouble is, I mean, as you know, the treatment isn't curative, and you do need to get a situation where the annual new infection rate really comes under control.
I agree with you, but I think that if they can prevent 5 to 10 years of death, delay death by 5 to 10 years, it's the same situation as with the cholesterol lowering drugs.
Yes, I definitely think that treatment has its place. I'm just concerned about the number of millions of new infections a year. I mean, it could just go up well beyond 6 million.
Richard, great talk. Question about on the obesity issue. You know, with tobacco, it's been easy to take on an enemy because the industry has been so, you know, awful, and it's been a key part of the tobacco control piece to sue and to expose and to really confront the industry. But in the case of obesity, it's inextricably involved with food policy, and I just wondered if what your opinion, your thoughts are about how the approach to industry may differ or not differ. In other words, should there be more sort of private-public partnerships that could be legitimately embraced as opposed to not being able to do that with the tobacco industry? So what's your thoughts about how best to deal with the industry side of the obesity epidemic?
I'm sorry, I really don't know, Tom. I think some aspects, I think, of food manufacture are relevant, like the type of fat that's used, but that's not relevant to obesity. It's relevant to heart disease rates, but not to obesity. And also salt content is perhaps relevant to blood pressure, moderately relevant to blood pressure, but not to obesity. It's difficult, isn't it? I don't know what changes are going to affect it. We've got a lot of data on the extent to which it does kill, and you can account for the adverse effects of obesity on vascular disease pretty well entirely by the known effects on blood lipids, blood pressure, and diabetes. I mean, so that's what there is, you know, that's the key thing that it's doing, is affecting blood pressure, blood lipids, and diabetes. Those things, I mean, trying to control blood pressure and blood lipids by attacking obesity rather than by treatment is actually quite a difficult way to attack them. I mean, it may be that we should be concentrating on the things that we can get relatively easily, and I think maybe pharmacology is useful. It would be, you know, obesity, I think, again, it's also a bit like alcohol. It doesn't suit people to be obese. I mean, you know, when you try and get studies, then it doesn't suit people to be uncomfortably obese. But what is going to be done about it? I'm sorry, I don't know. It's a very weak answer. I think it's like, you know, people say, what are you going to do about smoking? I'll give the rather cheap answer. I'm trying to measure the consequences of smoking rather than describe the causes. I think the same is true with obesity. I don't know which way it's going to go. We're doing studies in Egypt now, prospective studies, and in the study area we're going, the average body mass index of the women is 33. That's the mean. And so a fair number, you know, really quite a lot of them are well over 40.
Thanks. You showed us those wonderful slides of the lowering of childhood mortality that took place over the last century, most of which occurred before antibiotics and immunization.
The big changes were all before antibiotics.
We attribute to social and nutrition.
Hygiene. Clean water and sewage.
Yeah. My question really is the wonderful graph of benefit in cardiovascular disease began well before the statins were introduced. And we did do a better job of smoking, but our smoking habits haven't changed much over the last 10 or 15 years in the United States, I think, by national surveys. And our obesity has gotten bigger. Our uninsured and uncared for population has increased. And I'm finding it hard to see why we're doing so well and continue to look on that slope when other than the smoking cessation, we haven't done all that well.
Well, I think maybe quite minor changes in the type of fat that's eaten might be of more relevance than they're thought to be. You know, changes in blood lipids. I think we've measured blood lipids by measures that are rather too crude. Blood lipids may actually be more sensitive. You know, if you start just measuring the number of ApoA1 molecules in the blood, it's four times as informative as total cholesterol. And if we were really measuring which lipoprotein particles are the ones that are really cardiotoxic and which are really protective, we'd get things that are even more sensitive than that. So it may be that changes in diet, changes away from animal fats towards vegetable fats and so on, have actually, things that were thought to have any moderate effects may well have had quite substantial effects, as in fact the data from Eastern Europe would suggest.
Do you think there's evidence that we've changed our dietary habits for the better? We're still eating a lot of fast foods
There is evidence on average blood lipids. There are some changes which are favorable. I'm sure there are other people in the audience who can answer this more reliably than I can. What about you, for example? You could. Do you want to answer that? I mean, what?
We're doing better now with the statins, but that's still
only
a fraction of the people.
That's
are we choosing to eat a better diet? Is the real question.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood your question, but I think if you're asking how.
But to what extent can the improvements be explained by changes in the known risk factors, changes in treatment and in the known risk factors?
I think some of that is thought to be not so much. Most of the early improvement is in preventive type measures and the lipids, but part of that improvement is due to the massive change we've had in the treatment of acute MI, which has saved a lot of deaths in this in the acute setting. The secondary prevention beyond that, but we also treat MI better.
Yeah. Last question.
Hi, Jill Koshel. I just wanted to ask you quickly about malaria and drug resistance.
I'm sorry, can I see you?
Malaria and drug resistance. So just given the past patterns of introduction of anti-malarial drugs followed by drug resistance, if we can make the current effective treatment affordable and distributed on a wide level, how can we also address the issue of drug resistance that might thereby follow?
Well, the recommendation on malaria is that artesunate should be used only in combination with another treatment. And the only way that that can be guaranteed is if the combination is subsidized so that it's actually less expensive than either of the drugs on their own. Because always, if you want to encourage combination therapy for any anti-infectious treatment, but particularly for malaria, if you want to encourage combination therapy, you've got to be combining two things, each of which would be effective. Otherwise, neither protects the other. And if you're combining two things that would be effective, then the price under ordinary economic circumstances is going to be higher than than either of the things on their own, and probably substantially higher than one of the things on their own. And so if you've got a poor family, you know, people that are really poor, they're going to, the rational choice would be to use one or other of the monotherapies if these are available at their natural prices rather than the combination. And so you will then produce resistance. And so the Institute of Medicine has argued in their report a couple of years ago on anti-malaria, they've argued that you need a global procurement agency that will procure good quality combination therapy and then will resell it, will distribute it worldwide at a cost not only lower than either of the separate components, but lower than really poor quality separate components. Otherwise, poor quality separate components will be manufactured and distributed and will undermine treatment strategy and will undermine the strategy of trying to protect the drugs. And it's actually quite a strong argument. I think it actually, that it's quite a big political decision to make to really get a global procurement agency. And it, this is being considered now, and it's being considered increasingly seriously. And if that happens, I think that's the right way to go. The total cost, it's estimated at the moment, we have the order of $500 million a year, but it's difficult to know. The prices might well come down if you're really getting large-scale manufacture. So that would be the ideal, but I don't know whether it's an achievable ideal. But certainly, if that were possible, then one could try and get the subsidized stuff available at low cost at village level for use by non-medical workers. That's the ideal. And the decisions are political, and they're really being argued over now. And we'll see what happens a few years from now. We've just got a lovely opportunity at the moment because artesunate is just so is such a nice class of drugs.
Richard, this is great. We hope you can come back in a few years and tell us how to live 10 years longer or maybe eternally. So we'll look forward to that revisit. Richard's going to be speaking in small groups with the Fogarty on the prevention of cardiovascular mortality at 3 today and on the prevention of malaria mortality in children tomorrow morning at 8 at Fogarty. So, Richard, thank you so much for your visit. I think you've entertained us all and you've given us tremendous food for thought and encouraged us to lose weight, stop smoking, and take our statins. Thanks.